Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. It's, of course, Adam Lowther, along with Jim Petrosky and Curtis McGiffin.
Howdy.
And today, hey guys, today we're going to do something we haven't done. It's been a while. We did this once before. We'll do it again. And so we had a listener, John in Maryland. And John,
hi, John.
Sent us. Yeah, hey, John.
I thought John M.D. meant he was a doctor.
Oh. You forgot the NMD part.
Congratulations, John. You're an MD.
So John sent us a series of questions. You know, he listens to the show, and thanks for that, by the way. And so he had some good questions. And the first one that I wanted to get into, and this is actually a really good question. And he says, to what extent would you say that at various points in American history, we've put too many eggs in the nuclear basket? And then he says, well, maybe starting in with the new look. And then he goes on and he adds that during the Cold War, I feel like we got a little lazy with nuclear deterrence as the primary force multiplier when there probably were other more innovative solutions that we could have come up with to counter a Soviet drive east. And then, you know, he says, did that sort of focus on nuclear weapons allow this dependence, let's call it, by the Europeans on the United States? And so therefore they weren't, you know, they became dependent on extended deterrence and were not thinking of their, you know, sort of their own security. And so let's sort of tackle this sort of three or four part question first. So, you know, let me go to you. I always go to Curtis first, Jim. So let me go to you first and see, you know, what's your take on this sort of multifaceted question?
Well, I'd like to do this like a pizza and eat it one bite at a time or one piece at a time. And I think we should start out with one. And I really want to get to three. So let's, so Curtis, you're going to have to curtail your discussion so that we get to three today. But I did want to start out, first of all, to say thank you, John, for your question. And thank you for putting up right up front that you're certainly not anti-nuclear. Neither are we. We're NIDS. But he does bring up a very good point in saying, looking at, you know, putting too many eggs in one basket in the nuclear umbrella and covering Europe. And I agree that oftentimes when you provide something for someone else, as we've done, and it is in our interest, that they tend to back up and say, oh, you're going to take care of this for us? That's fine. You know, I remember back in the day when I was a younger lieutenant, and we were, you know, doing our planning and mission operations for the Fulda Gap, and we looked at the, you know, using nuclear weapons as a way of, you know, performing warfare in that region to be able to cause the Soviets at the time, okay, to coming east through that area. And we had a very specific role and a very deliberate role of utilization of nuclear weapons in the region. But I do think over time, what has happened is that dependence on the U.S. to provide that completely and totally can be seen by Russia, and especially Putin. And we see some of his advances right now that are seen as Europe doesn't care, and the United States is far away, and we're not sure that, and I'm going to say that lightly because I'm not in those bands, but we're not sure that they're fully built into this nuclear use if we make that move. And I think, you know, Ukraine was a good push to see what happens, you know, on a small scale. You know, this goes back to last week's episode, or maybe a 2 week ago episode, where we talked about, you know, how nuclear weapons, you know, may preclude great power war. But still, I do want to emphasize that our nuclear umbrella in Europe has kept them from having a great power war. In fact, all those great power wars for some, 50, 60, 70, I don't know. I don't do math in public. But for a long time, we've not had these great power wars. And so kudos to us for putting it there. And we'll get to this, you know, non-proliferation, because I think it fits there. But the nuclear umbrella can cause, if we do not ask our allies to pick up their fair share, to pick up their need, it does send a message to our adversaries that they don't care. And that is a problem. So I think he brings this up as a very, very astute view, in my opinion. And that's my view. Curtis?
Yeah. Okay. Curtis?
I disagree with a little bit of that response. Good. But first of all, it's 80 years. That's the public math. And and so what I would say here to John's question, thank you, John. And by the way, this is my favorite episode when we answer viewer questions. So I would love that we did this all the time. Okay. So apathy, did we do too much? You know, so let's think about this. And there's more innovative ways. Nuclear weapons was the innovative way to prevent a third world war in Europe. Okay. So let's understand there was a world war. Well, there'd been world wars in Europe for centuries. I mean, if you want to call it great power clashes, conflicts, you know, whether you're talking about Napoleon's March, World War One, et cetera, all the way to World War Two. And what the world didn't need, right, was another massive conflict on the European continent. And so nuclear weapons was the new technology to avoid that war. And so Eisenhower's New Look strategy was essentially the first offset. It was a way to economically be able to protect Western Europe without having to mobilize a large army. It allowed us to demobilize much of the World War II army and be able to spend that money doing other things in the 50s, including building the interstate highway system and other things that Eisenhower was interested in. And so what the big challenge became was when the Kennedy administration came in and they looked at this and they believed the strategy of massive retaliation to be less credible, that we didn't believe that we would go to war, drop an atomic bomb, if you will, for small incursions or maybe single point in invasions, you know, vis-a-vis Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And so they went on to this flexible response, assured destruction strategy, which Europe hated. They did not want to spend that money on building conventional forces in the 1960s. And to sort of rearm NATO, which we're starting to have to do again now. And because they were afraid that we were now going to fight a conventional war before they fought a nuclear war in Europe. And so so the methodology of defeating, if you will, deterring the massive size of the Warsaw Pact was the innovative use of nuclear weapons. So I would say that was the right answer at that time. It kept the peace. And ironically, as we have said in past podcasts, and we'll say again in future podcasts, the nuclear weapons, of which many people have feared in the Cold War would be the start of World War III, actually prevented World War III for that fear of escalation. And so I would say that that was the right thing to do. That was the technological answer.
Wait a minute, Curtis. Are you trying to say you proved a negative?
I did. So how do we measure the lives not lost in the next war that didn't happen? It's a difficult metric. I get you.
I only say that because it's always used to bludgeon us in the other direction. Like, well, how many lives would have been saved if we didn't use the nuclear weapons in World War II?
Right.
I don't know. I mean, come on.
So let me add context. So let's go back to January 1953. You know, Dwight Eisenhower on January 20th takes office, and you're Dwight Eisenhower. So you had previously been the commander,
that's right,
of Allied forces during World War II. You had seen 100 million people killed. You had seen Europe destroyed. You had seen devastation in, you know, much of Asia. And what you've said to yourself, and then also, oh, by the way, you had promised to end the Korean War.
Right.
Which it happened you know, within a few years. We're not even really done with trying to stabilize the world post-World War II. And so now you're president. And remember, during World War II, the U.S. spent almost 50% of gross domestic product. Like, if you think about it right now, the federal, state, and local governments tax about 40% of GDP. That's what they tax. So take that money and take every single dime of it and spend every dime for the war. And then you got to do all the other functions of government on top of that. So that was a period, and, you know, the United States went into massive debt during the war. We didn't pay off all of World War II's debt until the 21st century. We did not pay off the last World War II loans until the 21st century. Most people don't realize how much debt we incurred. And so Eisenhower knew and understood what position we were in 1953, and he wanted to prevent it. And so what he said is the best way to prevent that, because we would have to, you know, have 100 divisions in Europe. He knew that would be massively expensive. So he said, well, listen, here's what we're going to do. We're going to constrain ourselves to where our only option is the use of nuclear weapons. And we're going to tell the Soviets we have no other options. So if you mm-hmm. choose to invade, our only option is going to be to nuke you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that, because we're out of Schlitz without it. And so therefore that's our option. And the criticism of the New Look policy was, well, but what about brush fire wars in Africa or Asia right. or wherever else they might be? It can't deter those. And you know, what he would say, what Eisenhower would say is, well, we're not trying to deter them. We're not going to get involved in them.
Right.
What we want to do is we want to ensure stability in Asia and in Europe, because that's where great power wars are going to happen. And so it was highly successful. And then as you move into the Cold War, we spent on average during the Cold War 5% of gross domestic product. So 5 cents on the dollar is what we spent on defense. And so my question to you is, if you, let's just put it in your own personal, you know, home and stuff. If you had to spend a nickel of every dollar you made on, you know, doors that lock, an alarm system, maybe you've got, you know, a home defense weapon, you've got the, you know, the alarm service, you've got cops, you've got all these things to protect your property. Is that a nickel you're willing to spend? And I would say probably, yeah, I'll spend a nickel if that's what it takes, you know, to protect my home, because that's what we spend to protect the nation. And then of that nickel, about 2 cents were spent on nuclear weapons. So basically we were spending, you know, 2 cents at the height of the Cold War. That's at the height when we spent the most. By the time, you know, 1991 rolls around, we're spending 1/10 of one cent, you know, 1/10 of one penny on it. So, you know, I would submit to you that we never really overspent, and we never really over-focused on it. But you are correct in the sense that anything that's an iron law of economics, anything you subsidize, you'll increase the demand for. This is why, as the United States has expanded social welfare programs, poverty increases. That's a proven fact. Social welfare programs don't eliminate poverty like LBJ wanted. They expand poverty because they increase the demand for poverty programs. And so apply that same logic to Europe, the Europeans wanted more. When you give them free security, they want more free security. And that's just the nature. That's human nature. Human nature responds to incentives. And when you incentivize dependency, you'll get more of it. That's just human nature. And so it is what it is.
Let me add to that.
Sure, Adam, go ahead.
Let me get to that great analogy, and that is, first of all, the amount of money that we paid to fight World War II as we did is about $4 to $4.5 trillion today.
Okay, so inflation adjusted, I just did the numbers, it's 5.85 trillion.
Okay. So So I didn't account for the Biden administration's inflation rate. So, and also in your nickel analogy, because I think you left something that's crucial out of that.
Okay.
In that nickel also bought the United States incredible status in the world, yep. right? As a superpower, as a peacemaker, as a stabilizing capable, which grew our economic capacity and made us more prosperous. So to take your analogy, if you were willing to spend 5 cents of every dollar you earned and not only secure your home and your family, but that nickel also made you mayor of
the most
popular guy in town.
Exactly.
And made you the person that everyone came to ask every question, the great guru of the community, what an investment that is, right?
Yeah.
So it's more than just the security factor. There are the second and third order effects of that.
It's, you brace a great point, because the other part of it is that by virtue of spending that money on nuclear weapons and preventing great power war, we actually reduced the amount on average of defense dollars you spend, because wars are incredibly expensive, right? We think that the total amortized cost of Iraq and Afghanistan is about $7 trillion. That's what, and we,
over,
you know,
20
Iraq
years.
And over yeah. 20 years, it was $7 trillion. That's a lot of money for very little. We got nothing, right? War's mm-hmm. not a productive thing to do. And so nuclear weapons, by virtue of preventing those great power wars, saved us a lot of money being spent to blow That's things right. up. And so the advantage there is that you can then reallocate resources. So instead of taxing money, spending it on wars, we then have money left over that we could build things like
the highway system.
Or companies like, because it's not getting taxed, our tax rates are lower. We then have these companies like IBM and Apple and Google. And did you know that I have this device that I hold in my hand, and I can talk to anybody anywhere on the face of the earth and in real time and look at them with this tiny device on that fits in my hand. Oh. And I can ask God. I think you spell it G-O-G-G-L-E, but I can ask God any question and know anything I want to know at any time. And it's all in the palm of my hand.
We could kind of do that in the 1950s. It was called a rotary telephone.
Yeah.
But the point is that we have the excess capital to then go do those things.
Yes.
And that creates a level of prosperity. I mean, think about it. The average right. American home today is like 2,800 square feet. Mm-hmm. That's unprecedented prosperity that we That's can right. live like that.
Right.
I mean, and I don't know how, I mean, we're so well off that I don't know that anybody in America can survive without at least having one Ford Raptor. I don't know that that's possible. That's just the nature of our society today.
I'm surviving without a Ford Raptor.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how either one of you do it, but, but that's sort of tongue in cheek, but that's what nuclear weapons have provided.
All right.
Okay. Now let's move on to there's a second question that I want you specifically, Jim, to answer. And this yep. is one, and I'm going to sort of summarize it. And he says, hey, you guys don't really ever talk about the negative externalities of sort of the nuclear enterprise. And by that, I mean, like, what about the waste product? You know, let's talk about like Rocky Flats or the uranium enrichment facilities around the country, because there is I keep up with it because I live in Missouri, but there's a bunch of people near the St. Louis area who, apparently this company dumped, I think it was uranium in the creek, and then it got in the water supply, and then it's caused a lot of harm to, and it was an irresponsible company. Mm-hmm. And that company's out of business. And so there's nobody who's really being held responsible for that. So he's basically saying, what about the externalities, the waste, the land that's ruined? Talk about that in terms of, John mentions, it's probably less than coal mining and some of these other things, which is sort of good on John for saying, hey, let's take a comparative look at it for other things that make society work. So can you maybe talk about that for a few minutes? We can get to the third question before we run out of time.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I do appreciate that John looks at this from both ends, and he and you do have to do things by comparison. So let's first back up and say, when we first got into the business of nuclear weapons or nuclear energy in total, and I mean, you go all the way back to Madame Curie, who didn't fully understand the effects of radiation on the body. And she ended up damaging her body. There were professors that damaged their body because they didn't understand what happened. So you put that in context, say, well, if they harmed themselves, then we shouldn't have gone any further than that. Well, look where we would be today without the medical influence, without the nuclear weapons influence, without the energy influence that came from that technology. But every technology, that little device that you talked about you have in your hand, you know, the heavy metals, the mining, the damage that happens so that you can have the pleasure of watching cat videos, Adam, because I know that's really what you do. With that, there you go. But, you know, every technology has that, but nuclear gets a special place. And I understand why. Okay. One, you can't see it. You can't smell it. I get that. Okay. But radiation, and I have to do a little tongue in cheek here. I went down to Dayton schools one time to talk to the little kids about radiation, because I went to talk to them about how radiation comes from the sun and how there's radiation in the soil and everything else. But I was in uniform at the time, and I got a call the next day from a bunch of angry parents, called the school and said, why is some military guy coming down telling us there's radiation all around us? What are we worried about? So I didn't give them context, but for the adults in the room, there is context, and that is that radioactivity is in the earth, and coal's the good example. So in the past, we have made mistakes. There is no doubt that happened with that technology. And during the Manhattan Project, there was a need to get things done quickly. There was an effort to do that, but we have learned so much about controlling radioisotopes, controlling spillage, controlling leakage, controlling industries that dump or, you know, do things wrong, like happened in the St. Louis area. So I want to put that out there that, yes, you're working with something that has a hazard. But having a hazard doesn't mean you don't do it anymore. I think I've mentioned here before, people talk to me about, well, is a car safe? Well, not if you don't drive it. Okay. If it sits in your garage, you take your Raptor and sit it in your garage. And I know you probably would do that anyway, Adam. Sit it in your front lawn and everyone look at it and admire it on blocks with a tarp over the front window. But seriously, if it just sat there, it would be extremely safe unless you know, of course, got underneath it and fell on someone. That might be unsafe. I mean, where do you put safe versus unsafe? Instead, you have to put it in context. What is valued? What is gained by the technology you're developing? What is gained by the oversight, which we've developed since then, by the way, since the 1940s? What have you gained by adding the extra layers of understanding, the extra layers of security, by the extra layers of waste management that come with the area? So a lot of what people talk about are, well, this happened in the past. Yes, it happened in the past. Someone got in an automobile accident in the 1960s, and they said they stuck their face through the windshield, so maybe we should put seat belts in. Okay? It didn't mean we stopped all cars. We should do the same thing with nuclear. We learned something. Is there a benefit to mankind and benefit to us by having this? Yes. Let me answer a little bit about the coal issue, because it always is brought up and I always thought it was interesting. So when you mine, so a part of the process of getting the uranium for the weapon, of course, there's two ways of doing this. One is, for uranium, is separating out of the uranium. You pull up the ore out of the ground. By the way, it's naturally there. No one stuck it there. You know, the military didn't bury a bunch of uranium and now we're finding it in the ground. It's everywhere. It's naturally there. So that's one piece of it. And it's not very radioactive. And in fact, the same controls are put on uranium mining or, you know, uranium ore as coal ore, because it's not that the radioactive hazard comes from inhalation and ingestion. So you have to have mass, you have to do all these things, normally done in an open pit. But uranium ore, you know, basically has a lot more radioactivity than coal ore per pound. Okay, you say, okay, that's good. And in fact, it's regulated because it is an alpha emitter. by the way, alphas, you know, primary alpha emitter, alphas can be stopped with something like a piece of paper or the skin of your, you know, dead skin on your hand will stop an alpha. However, now let's talk about what we're really talking about. So the ore mining, it's in the ground, it's naturally, it's there, but less is used. Coal plants have a constant feed of tons and tons and tons of coal that are going in to burn on a daily basis. I'm talking about nuclear energy, but we can go back to weapons because it's much, much less. So that ore is, you know, is processed in such a way that can be used for uranium. The coal ore, of course, is used in the coal plant. But after you're done with it, you now have, and in fact, you know, it's an interesting fact, but coal ash, the residue after burning coal, has concentrated radioactive elements that emit more radiation than low-grade uranium tailings, the end result, the stuff that we're not using in the reactor, which is much more. Remember, reactor, you know, if you're making a weapon, you know, 0.7% of what comes out of the ore, 0.7% or 0.07% or 70 atoms per 1,000 atoms is what goes into the weapon. Everything else is the waste part, and it goes out. And that waste part is less radioactive than the coal. Now, in the processing of the material, there are many, many chemicals that are used. You know, one of the biggest issues that still exists today from the Manhattan Project is the use of mercury that was then disposed of. And I'm not agreeing with this, but it was disposed of by dumping. And, you know, there still today can be found pools of mercury in the ground that can be hazardous. That's a chemical problem, not a radioactive problem.
So, Jim, are you telling me that when as a kid I always put mercuricone on cuts, that was a bad idea. Mercury wasn't going to fix my wounds.
So again, let's talk about the hazard versus the benefit. The benefit of mercuricone, because you probably didn't have any available alcohol to put on it, Adam. So mercuricone was your next best bet to put on there. But the mercury's in there, and we've learned from that, and we don't use, you know, we don't have mercuricone sitting around in the houses anymore as we did before, because it does present a hazard, especially developing brains, which might explain a little bit about where you are, Adam. But anyway.
the lead paint you ate.
But anyway, so as we go. But anyway, in all seriousness, yes, we learn. So we didn't say, oh, mercuricone was bad. Let's get rid of all medicines. Let's say, here's what happened. Here's how we change it. Here's how we do it. And so this is 2025. This is not 1945. So we've learned from the past. But the not in my backyard attitude, I understand that mistakes have happened, but mistakes can be fixed. Now, let's talk about Rocky Flats a little bit. So Rocky Flats got closed, but much of the reason for Rocky, and there were, you know, there were inventory errors, there were dumping errors that were done at Rocky Flats. Those are known. They're in the paperwork. We understand that. But Rocky Flats, and you know, they can be long-term damages. You know, we still can go out to Rocky Flats and find damaged areas. We learned from that. Now, there's two answers to Rocky Flats, in my opinion, and we'll be interested. Hopefully, we'll get some phone calls back asking questions about this. But my opinion is, you're right, Rocky Flats has damage. We can either re-clean it or use it for our next set of nuclear weapon development we do. And from the learned process, we won't do the things we've done in the past that may have done that. But mostly Rocky Flats closing was more, in my opinion, and you can challenge that, and I'd be happy to have that debate, was more a political closing than it was a necessary closing. In fact, if it was stayed open, we might have had better access to cleaning, developing, and continuing our nuclear weapons program, which would have had an advantage. So, you know, everything comes, you know, I'm an engineer, and you know, there's a saying by Henry Petrosky, not me and not related to me, unless he owes you money, then send me the money, I'll get it to Henry right away. But yeah, he was a well-established author. He unfortunately passed away about a decade ago. But he always said, with every solution comes a problem. And his good answer was, with every solution comes a problem. When you put a dam in the river to stop flooding downstream, you start flooding upstream, and you have the danger downstream if the dam breaks. So every solution has a problem. You have to accept the problem, okay, and look at the challenge. There's value in putting in a dam. There's value in building nuclear weapons. We have to decide that we want them and their value. And that's part of what we talk about in this podcast that I think is important. And a NIMBY crowd say, not my backyard. It's got to go somewhere. And I'd be willing to put it in my backyard. If someone wants to find out where my real estate is, I'd be happy to sell off a portion of my plant land to put in a nuclear power plant. Just give me a call. Because I see, you know, there's advantage. You can look at the safety requirements. You can look at cleanup requirements. Most cleanup requirements for nuclear power plants reduce the radiation in the air. They actually have to bring in dirt from that wasn't there originally from outside to cover the dirt that was there in areas that had higher concentrations of uranium. I mean, it's just crazy things because we fear what we don't know. I think that's from Superman or something. So, yeah. Anyway.
Okay, right. So we've got one more question, but we're already over.
I want to hear Curtis's answer. Okay, go ahead. I don't have anything to add to that.
Oh. I mean, other than Mercurochrome was taken off the market in 1998, so yeah. Don't worry, folks.
Sorry, Adam. I didn't mean to jump in there.
They actually do have a new Mercurochrome that looks the same but has no mercury. Okay, so we're already over 30 minutes, so we've got to make this response quick. So the third question is, do you guys think that non-proliferation was worth all the time, energy, and resources we poured into it? I get the sense it was not terribly effective and that we probably could have gotten similar results with 50% of the sound and fury expended on the boards of the world stage. So, you know, the quick question is, was all the non-proliferation, counter-proliferation effort, was it worth it? I get a quick answer? How about let's start with you, Curtis?
Well, it was worth it until it wasn't. So the problem with non-proliferation, in my mind, is that you're asking nations in a realist world to balance power without enough power and relying on someone else to be that power balance for you. And if you've lost trust in that other state, or that other state has turned on you, then you kind of left holding the bag. There were a number of states that attempted to become nuclear powers or be considering of it over the 50s and 60s, and that just hasn't happened, and for whatever reason. But I'll tell you the main reason is because it wasn't in that state's national interest to do so. Period.
Yeah,
I would say though that of all the nuclear powers out there, we've added more than have given up. Only one country has given up their nuclear weapons voluntarily, willingly, and that was South Africa. And so, but beyond that, it is very difficult to say that non-proliferation has been a complete success. But I would say that our efforts with extended deterrence, the nuclear umbrella that Jim talked about in the first part of this podcast, which has contributed to non-proliferation from an American or a Western perspective, has been successful in the sense that we don't have a lot of nuclear-armed NATO countries and so forth. There have been thinkers out there who have advocated for every nation to have a nuclear weapon. That if every nation had a nuclear weapon, we would be a completely safe world, right? Because everybody would be afraid of each other, then they'd be forced to get along. You think about the old Western days, right? An armed society is a polite society, and we all sort of have it in our minds that from movies that there was a gunfight at the OK Corral every day, or a high noon draw to settle a difference. For the most part, these weapons were tools to be used to tame the threat, and nuclear weapons are really not much any different than that. And it's undeniable the amount of peace and prosperity that they have enabled, not provided, enabled.
Okay, Jim.
Yeah, so I want to catch on to Curtis, and I'll give you the short answer. But Curtis, the one thing I think that nuclear weapons do differently than the OK Corral explanation is the fact that you do have large populations that are involved in retaliation and use. And I think that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Not good that large populations are going to die, but bad in that leaders, even autocrats, have to maintain a citizenry. You can't be an autocrat to yourself, except unless you're Adam. But You can be an autocrat to yourself. And, you know, in that view, you have to keep your citizenry and you have to keep them understanding that they're going to be safe. And so nuclear weapons add that other component to it that I think are interesting. So regarding the NPT, yeah, let's see. I think, you know, there's five declared, there's, you know, three that at
least nuclear powers,
declared nuclear powers, Israel sort of not officially declared. And then, you know, there's another like groups of people that have pursued this, but they will pursue it in their own interest. The minute they believe that we will not provide, or believe that we cannot or will not provide their protection, it goes onto the table. It has to, from a national standpoint, if they feel threatened. And so it's like, you know, I look at nuclear weapons, and I've always asked, and I'd be interested in what our listeners do, and I always ask my students, I said, why do nuclear weapons get treated differently than others? Well, they're a weapon of mass destruction. So are chemicals. So are biological weapons. Why does nuclear get a special place? I'm going to leave that to the audience so I can, you know, drum up some more questions. Why do they get their special place? I have my answer. I'll be interested what you do. But importantly here is that every nation that that has pursued nuclear weapons has not gone into a great power war so far. Well, I can only say so far because, you know, I don't know what happens tomorrow when the great asteroid hits or whatever else happens.
That's right. Well, I would just remind or let the viewers know, you know, so, you know, in Bhutto at the time, president of Pakistan, you know, made the statement in the 1960s that the country would eat grass and leaves if that's what it took.
Yep.
To obtain this power in order to secure themselves from whatever the threat that they viewed from their neighbors or perceived from their neighbors. So it was something that was important enough, so important, it was the number one priority in order to ensure their security and sovereignty. And that's what most states decide to do with this. There are a few bad actors out there that want to use these weapons to coerce and sort of enable their aggression. Most states do not do that. They utilize these weapons in a defensive mode in order to ensure their own survival and security. And that's what we're seeing here.
And, you know, some would say, well, you Americans and then maybe the Brits or the other nuclear powers, you guys are hypocrites because yes. you want to have them, but you don't want others to have them. And, you know, if for me as a realist, I guess I would, you know, go back to the great Thucydides and, you know, in the Melian dialogue where, you know, the Athenians tell the Melians, mm-hmm. you know, the strong do what they will and the weak do what they must. And, you know, in the world we live in, which is, you know, I would submit to use a fallen world with, you know, evil and all of that, then, you know, it's not a perfect world. And I don't think we're ever going to have, you know, sort of abject fairness. So therefore, I'd rather be the Americans who have the nuclear weapons as opposed to, you know, our adversaries who may not, like the Iranians. So, and then, oh, by the way, we're more than willing to welcome you into, you know, a friendly status and, you know, trade with you and have a positive relations with you and all that. We just ask that you not kill our citizens and don't try to, you know, advocate for communism or any of those other things. And we're more than willing to be friends. That's a great thing about this country is, well, you know.
Let me just close with this, I think, and appropriate to what you were just saying, Adam, and that is, if you've ever gone to, on Netflix, there's a great series called Godless. It's a modern Western, highly recommend it. But there is a scene where the bad guy, Frank Griffin, is sitting next to a child who's, he's the bad guy, and his gang is sort of roughing up this family, and he's sitting next to him, and the kid's scared, and he looks at the kid, and he goes, you know, son, ain't nothing more scarier than a man with a gun. And he says, ain't nothing more helpless than a man without one.
Yeah. All right. Well, gents, we're out of time. It's been a great discussion. Thanks, John, for those questions. And of course, we want to, you know, if there are any other listeners, if you want to send in your questions or comments, you know, please do so. You're always welcome to challenge us. We are not afraid of a challenge. So That's more than welcome. We'll be happy to discuss it on the air. Well, we might even have you on. So, you know, if you really want to come on and say, you guys got it wrong, like that, what's the movie, You Can't Handle the Truth. A Few Good Men. You know, we can try that too. So thanks for listening, of course, and please check out all of our great stuff coming up, QC events, Global Security Review, all the other things that take place at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. And, of course, as we end the show, we always want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.